This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Ever there was a woman who needs no introduction, it is this author. Leanne Moriarty is the Australian author of 9 internationally best-selling novels, including the number 1 New York Times bestsellers, The Husband's Secret, Big Little Lies, Truly Madly Guilty, 9 Perfect Strangers, and her most recent novel, Apples Never Fall. Her books have sold over 20 million copies worldwide, including 3 million in Australia and New Zealand. Big Little Lies and 9 Perfect Strangers have both been adapted into phenomenally successful television series, and a number of Moriarty's other books are in the process of adaptation or production. She is also the author of a children's book series, beginning with Nicola Berry and the Petrifying Problem with Princess Petronella, which I might add she originally wrote for her little sister and included the name of friend and fellow author Petronella McGovern, who helped us set up this interview. Thank you, Petronella. I loved this conversation on process, on Leanne not being a planner, character development, Hollywood moments, and so much more. And I particularly appreciated Leanne giving us her time and insights because publicity is not her favourite thing, and she's currently in the flailing about stage of a new novel. I do hope you enjoy. Leanne Moriarty, it is such a thrill to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my absolute pleasure.
We like to go back to the beginning, and I know that for any of your fans, they will well know the story of you and your sisters, two of whom, Jacqueline and Nicola, are also writers. Jacqueline's a big favourite in this house, that you were all paid to write stories by your dad. And I want to ask, was your dad a good first reader? Did he give you any constructive criticism, or was it just the nature of paying you to write the stories which got you going?
I don't know that he actually read them. I doubt that he did. I have no memory of him saying this is good or anything like that. It was more you'd filled an exercise book with words and here's your payment.
Did you read them to each other, your sisters and you?
I'm sure we read each other's work. I don't remember reading out loud. We definitely told each other stories because I can remember Nicola saying that I used to tell her a story that was supposedly very similar to the Harry Potter story. And she told me that excitedly. And I remember saying, that's not good news. we told each other stories because Jackie says, I told stories, so she then followed the tradition, passing it on. Yeah, and I wrote a story for Nicola for her 10th birthday, which was, I must have been 25, and our mutual friend Petronella, I was working with her at the time, so the author Petronella McGovern. So I wrote a story which featured Nicola and Princess Petronella, and I finished writing that for her. And that many years later, I did actually publish. So that was my children's.
Yes, I wanted to ask about that children's series because it's often, you know, it's down to the side on your website, but very much there. Will you ever write more for kids? Have you written for your own children?
Well, the problem is that the children's books didn't sell as well as the adult books. So I do sometimes get messages from little girls or boys as well saying, it seems like Nicola Berry is in grave danger. That's how the last book ended. And I have to say, I'm sorry, she has to stay in grave danger unless the children's books start taking off.
Oh dear, Nicola Berry. Okay, maybe there's a young writer out there who will get Nicola out of grave danger. Yeah. That relationship with Jacqueline and Nicola, obviously very important on a writerly level as well as sisterly. And despite your early dream to be a writer, Jacqueline pipped you at the post, and she did it first. And you've described this as a catalyst for you writing your first book. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so it's meant to be that the older sister does everything first. So I got my driver's license first, and you know, all that sort of thing. And we both wanted to be writers when we were little. But then I think as I got older, I just lost that crazy confidence that I had as a child. And I do remember we both wanted to write a story together once. And I wrote the first chapter, she wrote the second chapter, and I can clearly remember thinking, this is too good, she's too good. I'm not writing another. And I said, I'm too busy. I was too, you know, too busy being with boyfriends or whatever. So that didn't go any further. And then I remember going to visit her. She studied at Cambridge. And sitting on her bed in her room and reading Feeling Sorry for Celia, which was her first novel. And I did say, this will definitely get published. Mm. But I say, in my mind, I remember thinking it's amazing, but I still didn't think real people got published. So that was nice of me to say that when I did, apparently. But, of course, it did. And so then it was probably a year or so later when I got the call from her, and I can very clearly remember where I was and what I was wearing and the feeling that I had, which was pride for her because I love her dearly, but also pure sibling rivalry. Because she'd done it first and I hadn't even tried. So it wasn't like I could say I'd given it a shot. I hadn't even given it a shot. So she always says that she thinks that I would have eventually done it, but I don't know, which is generous of her. I don't know that that's true. I think I needed to see her do it first.
And have that feeling. It's incredibly powerful, that kind of push, that momentum from sibling rivalry. How long was it then until you started writing? Because I know that you went to do a master's. Did that happen straight away, or were you writing, you know, did you try it on by yourself first?
I did write. I know that it was around the time of the Sydney 2000 Olympics, because or it must have been coming up, because I wrote a book called The Animal Olympics for Children, and that was enthusiastically rejected by every publisher in Australia. And then I calmed down and I enrolled in a master's degree. So I'm not sure actually of the, I'm not good with years and the timing of it all. I feel like it all perhaps happened quite quickly.
Because those rejections, that enthusiastic rejection from every publisher in Australia didn't dampen the spirit. You were still fired up to get this happening.
Yeah, I think so. And I think perhaps I hadn't really put my heart into
the Animal Olympics.
I don't know how I would have gone if my first novel, Three Wishes, if that had been rejected by everyone. That might have been harder to...
Yes, because that happened, that got picked up quite quickly after the completion of that master's. Tell us how that happened.
I can remember the post box where I posted it, and I can remember the envelope, the yellow envelope, and sending it on its way.
Did you send it to an agent, Leanne, or to a...
Curtis Brown. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, actually, I can't remember listening to the phone call the first time. I can remember replaying the phone call from Fiona Inglis to a friend of mine, and because I can remember her standing there, so it must have been on an answering message, and I can remember her grabbing my arm and to her words. So that's always a lovely memory, just saying that she wanted to represent me.
And then was it a whirlwind from there? You know, now that you know, I suppose, how things have gone, could you ever have expected that it would get to here? Was it a quick auction? Were there lots of people bidding or was it slower?
Wasn't a whirlwind, maybe a light breeze. I don't think it all happened slowly. And I often wonder how authors go whose first book is a huge success. For me, Three Wishes, it was published in the US and the UK, But perhaps because Jackie had also been published in the US and the UK, I thought, well, this is how things work. And it sold quite nicely, but it definitely wasn't a huge success. But I was thrilled. I was thrilled just because it sounds like I'm being too humble that I didn't expect anything more, but I was really honestly just happy to be published. And I haven't ever been one of those people who's really involved with the industry and knowing which books are selling. I've always been kept myself, perhaps deliberately, a little oblivious of all that. So I can always remember somebody saying to me, or a review that said, she should be getting more critical respect. And I thought, aren't I getting critical respect? I didn't know. So I think, you know, in a way that meant that I could just start writing the next book without much expectation, just thrilled that I had another publishing deal.
It's so interesting, Leanne, because one of the common threads that's come up in particular in the Master Series, talking to writers who are at the, the top of their career or have got more books under their belt, is this treating it just like work. And I know, you know, to some extent I can see that, you know, that many of these writers have come to a point where they're financially able to do that as well, but not engaging so much in the industry, not engaging in the reviews, not engaging in that other stuff, but just coming back to the desk and doing the work. So I want to ask you a little bit about that process for you. I know that there's an egg timer, or there has been in the past. I know that there's a word count list.
Yes.
Tell me, what does the writing routine look like for you?
Yes, it's not. I do enjoy hearing those authors who are very systematic about it, who say that they get up each day and go for a walk and write at for this time and have a particular type of tea. I'm a little bit more ramshackle. But yes, I especially once I'm getting into it, I do like to be a word counter, mainly because I'm not a planner. So the temptation is always to go back and edit what I did the day before, because I don't know what's going to happen. And I still, I like that because that's my way into the novel, to edit what I've just done. But I can spend too much time if I don't set myself a word count. So I normally have a little notebook where I'm the eldest child, so I like approval. I write little things like, well done, Leanne, good work. So, and I just write the words that I did today. And as the novel goes along, then I'm writing more words. So in the early stages, I might just write 500 words a day, but then towards the end, 2,000.
I love that. Well done, Leanne. I heard that in you talking about that in a great interview on How I Work. I'll put the link in the podcast. And it was so similar to Sarah Centilli's, the US writer who I often do masterclasses with, and she asks writers to leave a love note to themselves at the end of the day for the next morning, so that they can, you know, get up and get cracking straight away, which is nice. But I also did note that you, despite all your success, also struggle with the negative self-talk that can come into one's brain while they're writing. What are the most recurrent phrases that you tell yourself when it's not going well?
I don't know if there's a particular phrase. Let me think. But sometimes I just think I can't do it. I always remember interviewing a cellist for my novel, Truly Madly Guilty, and she was saying that there are some days where she just felt like she couldn't play. And I was so amazed because in my mind, I thought, once you can play the cello, surely you can play the cello. Mm-hmm. And she would say, no, there's some days you just feel like you can't do it. And always at the beginning of a novel, I think, I just can't do it. I don't know how to do it. It's impossible. So there's just a lot of flailing about at the beginning. So it's not so much you're no good, although sometimes there might be, you know, if you start thinking about bad reviews that then I think, but it was really hard. It was really hard to write. And you say, so how embarrassing. It was so hard to write and it's not even any good. So I can get myself worked up about that. So it's just knowing that eventually I'll lose myself in the story, and then and that's the part I'm waiting for when that all falls away.
Does knowing the flailing about always happens at the start make it any easier? Does it feel unexpected every time? Or is there a, you know, are you able to say, okay, I know that if I walk, see my friends, keep turning up to the page, eventually this will pass?
No, it feels unexpected each time. And then I think, yeah, maybe I always say to my husband, maybe I just can't do this anymore. So no, it does feel, so that's also part of the process, the flailing about, the assuming I can't do it anymore. And I did with the Apples Never Fall. I remember I thought I loved writing it so much. So I got past that flailing about and I was thinking, oh, I'm enlightened now. I was somehow enjoying the process so much that I was thinking, I don't even care if you know what people think of it. And I heard some podcast with some, he might have been a rapper or something like that, and he was saying something, it seemed incredibly wise, and something clicked in my mind about just enjoy the process. It should all be, and if you give your heart to it, it doesn't matter what people say. And I really felt that for quite some time. But then, yeah, once the book came out, it was all gone.
I'm so glad. I know that so many people are going to be so reassured to hear that exactly the same feelings of imposter syndrome and all the rest of it come to you as well.
Sure.
You said you're not a planner, and this is kind of very, very famous that you've said this, and yet you create these complicated plots with twists and mysteries and red herrings. So I want to ask how you manage the possibilities of plot when you are just coming at it each day. How do you hold it in your head or investigate those possibilities?
So I always have to have a document called Things I Need to Fix. Because that means because I am working it out as I go. So for example, in Apples Never Fall, it became important that the character Stan did not own a mobile phone. But in the very first scene, I had him lying in bed looking at his mobile phone. So I can clearly remember the first thing on the list was take Stan's phone off him. So things like that. And then other things just work out beautifully. That's wonderful when it happens. So for example, again, in Apples Never Fall, there's a scene where a character had something to do with the bananas in a bag. And then afterwards I thought, oh, that could be significant. And that was wonderful when that happens, because then I don't have to sort of shoehorn it in. So I love that. So sometimes those things just fall into place. It never means that it's just all working out completely as I go. I never want to give that impression that I don't plan and it all just magically comes together. There's a lot of panic that that I won't be able to do it. That I remember The Husband's Secret, I had these three plot lines and I was thinking, what's going to happen? Am I working myself into a corner here? And I can remember the exact intersection I was where it all came. I suddenly thought, okay, this will work for me.
Because it is a puzzle like that, isn't it? And I know that there have been times in my own writing where I've thought, oh, the book just got smarter than me. Like there's no way that I can actually solve the kind of riddle that I've created with something like The Husband's Secret or any of the Big Little Lies, any of the other kinds of books with multiple characters with these complicated plot lines. Do you have you've got your Things I Need to Fix document. Do you have a master document or a shapes written on the wall or a whiteboard, like just for managing all those threads? They can get so unwieldy when you're writing them.
Yeah, they can. And no, I don't. I can always remember an editor with one of my early books saying, check your timeline on such and such. And I thought, what timeline? I don't have a timeline. So no, I don't. I keep it all in my in my head, but it does mean it's a timeline which can get you into trouble where this has to have happened by, you know, you've got too much happening during the week and you need this to happen. So there are disadvantages to writing without a plan. Mm. My sister Jackie, she always plans her, she knows exactly what's going to happen. And we've both tried each other's way.
Doesn't work.
And it doesn't work. I don't know yet. And she says, she starts and she says, but how do you know? So it's just, there's clearly no right way.
There is no right way. If there's anything I've learned now from 5 years of this podcast, that there is a million different ways to do it and they work differently. And also that you can experiment with different styles, which is what writers love to do.
I was just going to say, I always remember when I had my first baby walking up and down the hallway and I realised in my mind, you know, the crying in the night, that I was searching for an answer, as if there's an actual answer that will come to me, and then suddenly thinking to myself, I've just got to do this. It's just between us, between me and him, and we'll work it out. So I always think writers need to don't look for somebody else's answer. It's between you and your work.
Oh, I love that. That's excellent advice. I want to ask you about inspiration for both plot and character. And you often, going back through interviews, you often reveal where your books begin. I think What Alice Forgot was in part from a newspaper article. Apples Never Fall was a combo of a writing prompt from your sister and listening to true crime podcasts. After that initial inspiration, where do you pull your characters from? How do you craft them?
So the characters definitely, I'd always miss my characters from my last book when I'm starting something new, because the characters in the beginning, I don't plan them either. So I'm not, I know J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter came to her fully formed. Mm. Whereas for me, I get to know them through the process of writing them. So I often say that I will start with an attribute of one sort. So I know I listen at the moment to Mark Maron, I think his name is. WTF is the name of his podcast. Mm-hmm. And he was in Glow. And anyway, he's just he's a nervous, full of energy. And I just remember going home and writing down that sort of attribute of a man, sort of aggressive in his anxiety. And so I know that I will end up creating a character who will have nothing to do with Mark. He won't, but that's an attribute. Mm. And I will just start writing. So then I'll perhaps make him or her say something, and then I'll try this and I'll try that. And maybe I'll combine another attribute from somebody else that I know or something that I think of, or even... I like it when I can a little habit of speech that people have that I might give to them, and that starts to make their dialogue. And then through the process of writing, eventually I'll get to know them and they'll start to move, and then I go back to the early chapters and rewrite. So then I think, oh, no, Madeline wouldn't say this. She would never do that, because now I know her, and I rewrite from there.
It's so interesting to me, the story of how after Big Little Lies was adapted, that you went on to create the kind of second season, the novella that becomes the second season for that. And I'm interested in how, having seen those characters get up literally off the page and walk around in the series, how you then worked with them, what that was, a kind of a reverse process in your mind, or how did it differ from your normal writing?
It was quite different. So I say that I wrote that with an American accent, because I definitely wrote for Reese's Madeline and Nicole's Celeste, and I wrote it all in present tense. In a way, it was sort of fun, because you didn't have to know how hard, one of the hardest things for a novelist to do is to get your characters from place.
Yes.
So I could just say, this is happening. So just scene after scene. The hard thing was that I have a lot of internal monologues in my in my writing. So obviously, if they can't think, they can't think anything. They have to. You have to. They have to say it. So I enjoyed it, but I wouldn't do that again. It did clarify that I'm a novelist, and I loved seeing. Obviously, it was a career highlight seeing Meryl Streep say some of the lines that I'd written for her, and doing that scream at the dinner table. So I'm thrilled that I did it, but I like writing novels.
I love that. And I love that when you say that you wrote for her, for Meryl Streep, you literally did write it for her. I know that this story, you've told this story lots of times, but can you please just tell us about wanting Meryl Streep and getting her?
Yeah. So that, again, it was Jackie, my sister, who, when I was saying to her, should I write this? Should I do this? Because, or should I say, no, thank you. And she said, you should just have fun with it, and why not, you know, write a role for your favorite actress or somebody you love. So that's when I thought, well, I'll write a role for Meryl Streep then. And so originally I was literally calling her Meryl as I wrote it, but that name didn't work for the character. And then I can remember I was going to look up and see what Meryl's second name was, and that's when I learned that her real name is actually Mary Louise, which worked perfectly for the character. So I put that in, and I can remember saying when I sent it off to the producers, and you know, saying feeling very audacious, but they, you know, I've written this role for Meryl Streep, and they were teasing me, saying, "Oh, Leanne, you've become so Hollywood, get me Meryl." And I can remember saying, if I can one day say to my friends that I said, get me Meryl, and you actually get me Meryl, I'll never ask for anything again. And then, then I got the email saying, we got you Meryl.
It is powerful manifestation.
Anyway, it wasn't true that I wouldn't ask for anything again. I then wanted Oprah, but I didn't get Oprah. I'm serious too. I wanted it.
keep going, Leanne. Let's talk a bit about the adaptations, and to continue to go full Hollywood fangirl. You were there, I believe, for the filming of the school trivia night for Big Little Lies. Did you manage to keep your cool for that? Had you already been in so many Hollywood moments that you were fine?
No, I had not been in many Hollywood moments. That was a completely surreal and just good luck. It was good luck for me that because I took the family over. But it was good luck that the school holidays happened to work in, and that I happened to be there at the time that they were filming those particular scenes, because I could have been there when they're seeing filming less interesting scenes. So it was, you know, the whole cast. And just lots of little things, walking by two stuntmen who were practicing how the fall would happen.
Oh, so wow.
Mats out, and the pretend glasses of, you know, the props. And of course, all their incredible costumes. So in the book, because it's set in Australia, I had, you know, the characters would have made just a token effort. You know, we're not as, but I did love the fact that they went full on with these amazing Elvis outfits, and I loved the outfit they had for Madeline, which was quite different from how I described, and I actually think probably she might have worn, so that shows where the wardrobe people that's what I really enjoy about it all, is just seeing what everybody adds.
Yes.
And how each actor, they have to create each character in the same way that we as novelists create characters. So that's one little thing that I've sort of taken away from it, that they do a lot of gestures, because they have to. So I've often written down, don't forget the gestures, because they have to make them move. You know, Meryl she'd take a necklace and hold it up to her lips and press it against the crucifix against her lips. So the actors are doing exactly the same as we're doing. They're looking around they're observing and taking little bits and pieces from people too.
It's such an absolute dream of mine to sit in a writer's room with a bunch of smart heads, or to collaborate like that, and just to think, you know, imagine how, the kinds of the depth to plot or to character that you get with such a big group of people, or on a group project like that. What has been your role, and has it changed from things between Big Little Lies and say Nine Perfect Strangers? Have you said, I want this much involvement, or I'm stepping back here, or I want to be able to do this? What's your involvement?
So that's not my dream, to be with the and I don't know if it's a failing on my part, because definitely you can see that everybody working together, and I've enjoyed working as part of a team just in my corporate life. But I want to keep control. When I'm writing a novel, I like the fact that I'm in charge. So I was very hands off. So I didn't. I preferred to hand it completely over and say, "Well, I've written the book, and nobody can change the book, and now it's yours." And I definitely believe that adaptations should not necessarily be 100% faithful to. It's a different medium, with a limited series. They want to have their arc within each episode. And I think if I tried to do it myself, if I tried to adapt my own book, it was obviously different when I was writing that treatment or the novella for season two. But if I was adapting my own work, first of all, it makes me almost cry with boredom at the thought of having to rewrite my own work, because I know what happens.
Yes.
So that I just can't, it feels like some sort of horrible university assignment to shoehorn it into another, and I don't know how to do, I don't know how to lay it out. I know this is of no relevance. You can get a program, I believe, but I don't like tabs. You know the tab?
Yeah. These are all reasons.
That would drive me crazy. The words would all jump about. So no, I was very hands off, and they kept me involved, just letting me know what was going on. And I know other authors have not necessarily had such a good experience, but they, for me, it was just a pleasure from start to finish, because they were just lovely to me. I just felt like a very interested bystander.
That sounds like a perfect kind of way to be. As you've become more successful, and there's obviously more demands on you in terms of the publicity side, and not obviously the last couple of years, but normally, you know, tours involving international tours as well, how do you arrange the boundaries around life and writing life, or even the creative part of the writing and then the publicity side? How do you manage all of that?
Well, for me, they're either using completely different parts of my mind or my personality. So I'm not one of those authors. I couldn't write this morning knowing that I would be talking to you, and I probably can't write this afternoon. I'll recover by tomorrow.
Thank you even more for speaking with us.
It's the agony of self-consciousness, and there's just too... No, because then I'd sit at my desk and think, oh, look at me, not planning. I'm too aware of myself. So I need to say I'll be doing publicity. I'd say no to a lot of things. But when a book comes out, I just accept, okay, so now I'm using that side of them. And in the beginning of a tour, I'm always awkward and not good at it. I do reach... I reach a point sort of in the middle where I achieve flow in the same way that you achieve flow when you're writing. So I'm doing the events and I'm feeling really good. And then there's always a point when I've been doing it for too long where there's self-loathing. Think, oh, my God, you can't tell that story again about your father commissioning you to write stories. Making myself feel ill. So by the end of it, I can't stand it.
So have you worked out then a sweet spot that, you know, you say to your publicity team, okay, we're only doing it this long and I'm going to try and avoid the self-loathing part? Or
So for me, it's probably also to do with having children, that I've always said I can only be away for 2 weeks
yep.
time. And that for me, maybe it was just that I'd know I was coming to the end, but by the end of maybe after 10 events in a row, and I know some authors can do heaps more, but I can't stand myself. I feel like I got drunk at a dinner party and talked about myself too much.
I noticed in one of the interviews you said about that you often tour with two other women, with two other writers. Is that a strategy to help, I suppose, share some of, some of those feelings? Is that something that you've...
It's really nice. Burr Carroll, who writes under B.M. Carroll, and Diane Blacklock, we used to do a lot of, especially around Australia, country tours, which makes it really lovely. So it's like a girls' weekend away. So I definitely recommend that to writers, to do it with friends, and then you can laugh about things. Like for example, there was one event we I did with those two where somebody came up afterwards and said, "Oh, that was so amazing." She said, "I thought you had to be really special to be a writer."
Meeting with readers is always such a glorious part. Do you manage that? I know that you have got Facebook, not Instagram and Twitter. Are these all decisions that you've made over time to protect, similar to protect those boundaries?
Yeah, so I'm not good with social media. So my sister Nicola, she set me up with, she and her husband set me up with the Facebook page right in the beginning, and they actually, or my brother-in-law, it's me talking, but he... runs it for me, and then I never ended up going on Instagram or Twitter. I think I just think about it too much. You know, Nicola's great at it. Nicola's on TikTok, but she's 15 years younger. So,
Leanne, there is always so much discourse around the idea of commercial fiction versus literary fiction. I know Di Morrissey has famously talked about having it all, including incredible book sales, but knowing she'll never be in the running for the Miles Franklin. Is this something that you think about in terms of the placement of your own books?
If I think about it too much, it's impossible to write. So I've had... seen reviews that say I'm Australia's Jane Austen, and I've seen reviews that say I write airport trash. So how can you know what I you lose that way lies madness if you start thinking about that.
Well, it's the moment you described earlier too about you know in the hallway getting your child to sleep that it has to be between you and the work.
Yes, exactly, and also I think. But what then it comes back to for me is meeting readers who are, and this is where I get cross with myself if I do let myself go off on worrying too much about that, because the readers I meet at my events are intelligent, mostly women, but not all just women, and they're so telling me they love my books or that it's meant something to them in some way. So how dare I? That's in a way that's... letting them down if I start to buy into into the airport trash rather than the, I feel far more fondly to the people who describe me as Australia's Jane Austen.
Yes, I like that. I'm so intrigued as to where you draw the ideas from and how they come up next. I know that, for instance, you've talked about the fact that you had the concept for Nine Perfect Strangers and then another one got in the way, and so you wrote, I think, Truly Madly Guilty.
Oh yes,
first, and then you went back to write it.
Yes,
I have. Are you already in process for a new book at the moment, or are you still in the searching around?
I'm in the flailing about stage, so I'm in the awful stage where I've got various things. And still, in fact, that because that original idea for Nine Perfect Strangers was. A tropical island, so it was all this idea about sending people, and so sometimes I'm thinking about that again. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, we wish you much luck for the flailing around stage, because we all know how awful that stage is. Leanne, I know that our listeners will want to go away with a piece of advice from you, and I know you've already given us so much, but if there was one piece of advice that you can give to the writers listening, what would that be?
So for me, when I'm writing, I'm always trying to get back to the way I wrote as a child. And sometimes I've seen my own son. He sometimes says, I'm going to do some writing. And he just goes and sits down and starts writing. And I look at him sort of with amazement, because I still have to get to the computer in a sidle up to it. And sometimes I don't even want to double click on the document. So it's trying to find that way to lose your sense of self, to write like a child, to just enjoy it. It's meant to be a pleasure. But that's not what I don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
That's wonderful. I love that. Michelle de Kretzer talked about it as the confidence trick, which is what you said earlier too, when we began, that you lost that confidence that you had as a child writer, and that's part of it, going in joyfully.
Yes, and just losing yourself in the story and thinking, I wonder what's going to happen as you write. So you've got just losing all that sense of here I am as a writer. It's the story that matters.
Leanne, we always finish with asking our guests if they could recommend a debut book anytime or any place. Have you got something that you could recommend for us?
Yes, I loved... It was called The Very Last List of Vivian Walker by Megan Albany. And it's about a woman, Vivian is dying. I've never read such a, it made me cry, but it was so unsentimental and funny. It was wonderful.
That is absolutely wonderful. Leanne Moriarty, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us and to sharing your wisdom with our listeners, who I know will be thrilled to hear from you. So thank you, and good luck in the flailing about stage.
You too. Thanks.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.